Hi, I'm Phelan Johnson.
And I'm Leah Simone Bowen, and we look at history a bit differently. Have you ever wondered how hundreds of wild horses came to inhabit an island in the Atlantic Ocean?
Or what Lord of the Rings and a small town in Manitoba have in common? Or the burning question, did Canada invent the teen drama?
The Secret Life of Canada is a podcast about the country you know and the stories you don't. New episodes available now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Q. I got a nice, easy question for you off the top of the show today. Super light, nothing to it. Do you feel like you're always your authentic self? Like when you talk to someone, do you feel like you're a little different depending on who you're talking to? When you're at work, do you feel like you're a different person than you are at home? I mean, that's kind of to be expected, right? But when it comes to making art, to making music, to being judged for your art, being yourself is tough. But if you ask Noah Kahn, he'll tell you it's powerful. Noah is a songwriter and singer from Vermont. He was signed to a record deal when he was young. He felt like the music he wrote then was going nowhere, so he went back to his parents' farm during the pandemic and started writing songs that felt more true to him, about his parents' divorce, about winter in New England, about mental health and drugs and drinking. And it worked. That is Noah Kahn, joined by Post Malone with Dial Drunk from his critically acclaimed album Stick Season. That's the forever version. So it all worked so well that Noah went from not doing too well to selling out the biggest rooms in the world. For instance, he just played three nights in Toronto to a combined 60,000 people. No flash, no choreographed dancing, just standing on stage with his guitar, pouring his heart out. So we asked Noah to come in on his day off in between the shows, and we were happy he said yes. He doesn't do a ton of interviews these days. He's very in demand, and this is the only Canadian one he did. I tell you, though, Noah Kahn is funny. He's honest. He can tell you how you can learn to be yourself, how eating a weed edible can be the thing to keep you from making a big mistake, and how he felt when he wore a wig at Olivia Rodrigo's concert and felt anonymous for the first time in a while. Here's my conversation with Noah Kahn. How are you?
Good. Thanks so much for having me and for that lovely introduction.
We're out of time for the interview now. That's it. You know, that was it.
Yeah, no, that's if we can leave it with that, that's great. I seem really cool and talented.
I saw this thing you said at one of your shows the other night that was you used to buy your own tickets to shows in Toronto so they would be sold out.
Yeah, yeah. So I can't remember the venue we're playing. It might have been Massey Hall.
Yeah.
And I think we'd sold like 900 out of 1,000 or something like that. Or maybe it was like 960 out of 1,000. And I went and I used my mom's privilege here. But I used my mom's credit card to to buy the last like 20 tickets or whatever. And I remember like being like, my show is sold out. And like forgetting that I actually had just sold my own show out.
The disconnect happened
yeah,
right away.
But I was able to like compartmentalize stuff. Like, this is so cool. I can't believe this many people are. And but then my mom like texted me like a month later. She's like, I have a charge for $500 on my card. Like, what is that? I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. And then I looked at it. I'm like, oh, it's because I sold my own show out.
It's $500 Canadian, though. It's like $150.
Exactly.
Bucks.
Don't worry about it. Exchange is great.
That's all right. Don't worry about it. Well, that must be meaningful to be doing. I mean, how many? You're doing three nights at Scotiabank here in Toronto?
Three nights, yeah, which is crazy. You know?
Yeah, it's meaningful to you, I bet.
Yeah, just walking around and seeing like the Drake insignia all over the place. Like, this is like his it seems like he has his fingerprints all over that venue, and it's like, wow, I'm playing where Drake plays. That's pretty cool. And you know, just like a moment when you're like watching the Raptors on TV and then remembering that you're selling shows out at that venue is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. I want to talk a little bit about sort of expectations versus reality when it comes to your career, because what I find really interesting about you is before this moment, before this record blew up, you had already been signed. You got signed to a deal when you were like how old?
I was 18 when I got signed.
And I think like there's a feeling that even you had that like that's going to be the world changer. Okay, I signed my name to a record deal. I'm going to tour the world. It's all going to be it's all going to be huge. I'm never going to be here again. I'm going to be on a tour bus and in a plane with Prince for the rest of my
life.
Can you talk to me a little bit about the expectation versus the reality?
Yeah. I mean, I came from a place where, like, I had absolutely no connection to the music industry. Like, I had no idea what it was like besides what I would see in movies. And, like, I truly was basing my idea of the music industry off of the movie The Rocker, which was, like, this terrible movie with Teddy Geiger and Dwight Schrute from The Office.
Yeah, Dwight from The Office was in it.
I actually think that the songs in that movie are great. I thought Teddy did a great job writing the songs. But, like, I watched the movie. I'm like, oh, that's what it's like. Like, you meet the record label guy. There's, like, the montage of, like, the fame and fortune. And then I get addicted to heroin and it's all over.
Right,
but
right.
Or that's not what happens in the movie. But that's kind of like what...
You were like, here we go.
Yeah, like, oh, shit. Like, at some point, I'm going to start doing hard drugs. Like, I don't want to do that. You know, so I didn't have any idea what the music industry was like, really. And I had always wanted to be a musician, but I was kind of lazy with, like, my dreams kind of didn't extend beyond, like, you know, getting signed. And so I got signed when I was in high school.
How?
I was just putting music on SoundCloud, and it was starting to kind of gain some traction, like, locally. Like, you would hear someone, like, driving by listening to the song. And,
yeah.
Or they'd play it before, like, the volleyball game or whatever. So I was getting some, like, local traction and, like, starting to make something of a name for myself, like in like the open mic and like local scene. I was playing like the gelato shop.
Wow.
I was playing like the Dartmouth College's like spring festival. I was playing like the first artist at like 1:30 p.m. Like,
right.
You know, so the song got found on SoundCloud by like a pretty, you know, well in tuned A&R public, because like the song was not blowing up at all by any metric. But he found it and then connected me with the manager. And, you know, the manager came to New Hampshire, where I was living at the time, met my parents, and that was kind of it. You know, he took me to LA, I recorded a few songs, and Republic Records signed me, like, you know, after like a showcase there.
Oh dear, I'm sorry that you grew up so soon. Cold year and no high school parties. I've been drinking alone. Oh, I've been drinking.
And so, yeah, I got in the music industry and, like, was immediately like, oh, my God, there's no, like, private jet picking me up. I'm taking the bus down in New York. I'm like, staying in the cheapest place possible. It was just a moment of, like, okay, this isn't, like, a dream. It's a dream, but it's not the dream I thought it was. And it took me a few years to wrap my head around that. And I think, like, that was a hard transition for me, being like, I'm going to follow my dream, then having to explain to people, like, why they still hadn't heard my music yet, or I hadn't put anything out, or I wasn't touring. And, you know, it was just an expectation versus reality moment.
It must have been, I hope you don't mind me saying this, like, it must have been a little embarrassing. Like, because people were probably like, oh, no, Noah really, he really did it. Like, oh, I heard that guy who's playing the gelato shop got signed. And all of a sudden you're home, you know?
Yeah, there's no, like, Instagram wasn't at the point where, like, you would take a photo of you signing a record deal at that point. So basically I was just telling everyone that I got signed, and they're like, uh-huh, yeah, okay.
Sure.
You're living at your dad's, right? So I was like, yeah, I got signed, and I think I don't want to go into the specifics of my record deal, but
please,
it certainly
please.
Was not a lucrative deal.
Yeah.
So the money wasn't, like, anything really that was going to change my life more than, like, a minimum wage job would. It was a little bit embarrassing, because I think I wanted to prove to people that it was, like, real. And, like, I don't think I ever pulled up my DocuSign record deal, but I was like, no, like, trust me, like, this guy's really in the industry. And it kind of was a lot of me having to convince people that it was happening.
Yeah, that it was even real at all.
Yeah. And then, like, you know, you go to, and I went to Nashville, about a year after I got signed, maybe 6 months after I got signed, writing songs every day with people that were, like, already skeptical of a white guy with an acoustic guitar walking into the room. You know, there was a lot of that at the time. I think part of the reason I got signed was because I had long brown hair.
Yeah.
Like James Bay.
Yeah.
And I was a little weird looking like Ed Sheeran.
Yeah.
And I was playing the acoustic guitar like George Ezra. You know,
you were James Sheeran Ezra.
I was James Sheer Ezra. And, you know, I think I was really just like a symptom of like that time, like that 2010s, like indie folk songwriter stuff, which is, I still love, obviously.
Yeah.
But looking back, the way I was signed wasn't like this huge dream come true. It was kind of like, I was kind of like a symptom of a genre and a feeling at the time, and I had to really like prove myself in those early days in sessions in Nashville, and like to show people that I was worth their time and that I wasn't just like another like, you know, artist getting cycled into the machine and thrown away.
A lot of what I want to talk to you about today is sort of this idea of like, hey, I the music I was writing before wasn't really authentic to me, and now the music I write is authentic to my life and it's working out really well. Was there like an aha moment where you're like, I got to write some songs that are a bit more true? Or is that just like a helpful press framing device?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. Like, I don't think there was one moment where I was like, this isn't making me happy anymore. I need to go to the mountains, you know? Like, it wasn't as cliche or as like stereotypical as that. It was, and you know, the music I made, my first two albums, I did like a lot at the time when I made them, and they did mean a lot to me then.
Hold me close and I won't leave, 'cause it hurts when you hurt somebody. So much to say, but I don't speak.
I think it's just that the half-life for that feeling was really short. Like, I would make the music and then like 2 or 3 months later, I'd be like, man, I don't care about that anymore. And then like with the second record, it was even shorter. It was like by the time the album had come out, I was completely done with it. I was actually writing Stick Season when the album was coming out. I was just kind of tired of the process more than I was the result. Like, I feel like the songs I put out, I did care about. It's just the way that I got to them was becoming so much harder. Like, you know, I was going to sessions in New York where I was living at the time, like, simply because I had roommates that were like working 9-to-5s and I wanted to like work a 9-to-5 myself in the music industry.
Right.
Because I always felt like this isn't a real job.
Yeah.
I make my own schedule. I'm terribly unstructured in my brain and my life. And like,
yeah,
I need to like wake up in the morning and go to the studio.
That's like that's a romantic thing that a lot of songwriters talk about. Like,
right.
I think they read that Rivers Cuomo article from Weezer where he was like, I approach it like a job. I take a lunch break in the middle of the day.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get it, you know?
Totally. And it's really hard to do that, but it's also hard to not do that because otherwise, like, you watch NBA slam dunk compilations for 2 hours, like go eat food, go on your phone, make something for 10 minutes that might change your life, and then like play FIFA. And it's like, dude, like that can work. Like, and that has worked for me, but I don't like that it works because it makes me feel like I'm not valuing half of my day. Like, you know, like sidebar here, but like Stick Season I wrote in like 25 minutes after a session, like, and the song has completely changed everything about my life, like fundamentally.
Can we listen to a little bit of it?
But it's the season of the sticks, and I saw your mom, she forgot that I existed, and it's half my fault, but I just like to play the victim. I'll drink alcohol till my friends come home for Christmas, and I'll dream each night.
I got goosebumps. I love that song.
I love this song too, man. Like, I still love it. I love how much joy it brings people when they hear it. I love that I still feel like I still feel the same emotion in that song that I did when I wrote it. And I just love it. And like, I'm so grateful for it. And I'm so like aware of like the massive privilege it is to have one song that can like really catapult your career.
Yeah. Can you go back to what you were saying that you like, I'm sort of obsessed with the where and when of people who write the song, where they come. I talked to name dropping, but I talked to Brandon Flowers one time.
Oh, cool.
From The Killers, and he told me this story about. I asked him about the same kind. I was having the same kind of conversation. They were like struggling. They were like a band in Vegas, whatever,
yeah.
You know. And he said he was in his sister's daughter's childhood bed.
Wow.
Because he had nowhere else to go.
Yeah.
And he was just kind of looking at the world around him, and he felt like there's nowhere to feel more depressed than like in your sister's. Your sister has a life, and you're in the daughter's
And even the daughter has a life.
Yeah.
Even she's, like, out, and you're just, like, chilling.
And he wrote Mr. Brightside.
That's crazy.
So what's yours?
Yeah. That is way cooler than mine. I got to make some shit up. I'm on top of a roller coaster. I was in Mount Everest, actually, when I wrote that song.
A lot of people don't know that, but actually, I didn't
have any jacket on. I was up there, t-shirt and shorts.
Didn't even have a guitar. It just came to me.
Yeah, you know? The guitar sounds you hear are actually me with my mouth. My story, I think the story of this song is, like, emblematic of, like, why the record was important to me, and it was like a good like microcosm for like a larger issue in my life at that time. Look at all those big words I just said.
Killed it.
I was recording my second album, I Was I Am, and And I was working with Joel Little, who's incredible, by the way, and like did an amazing job on that record. And I, whenever I talk about this record, I try to be really sure not to like sound like I'm, you know, negating his talent and his effort, because it means the world that we did that together. And I still love a lot of the songs. But we were working on it. He was in New Zealand and I was working from his studio in LA, like remote engineer Mark Rankin in there. And we were like on the Zoom every day. And I was just burnt out. And I would, so I would go back to the Airbnb I was staying in. And it was an Airbnb that was like in the middle of, like the window looked out into like the courtyard of like a ring of the apartment building. I would go back to Airbnb and I would just like get high and like make music that I would never show anybody else. And I had like was writing a bunch of songs that night and I was like, I want to put one of these on TikTok. Like I just want to like put something up on the internet and like stay relevant for a second here. I wrote the first verse to Stick Season and I was thinking about how I had to buy weed from high school kids as like a 23-year-old guy. And I was like, you know, I have to go to like drive into like the pizza parlor in town. I just felt like I felt like a washed up guy in my career.
Yeah.
And then I was at home and I felt like a washed up dude in like in my life.
Yeah.
Even though it had like at that point like hundreds of millions of streams and I've toured for a long time. It's just like I just still felt like I think I felt so disconnected from the music that to me it felt like I didn't even have a job.
Yeah.
And so I started writing about that and like I posted on TikTok and like no one was commenting on it or whatever. And I was like, man, do I just delete this? I succumbed to like the social media success of something really easily. And, which is like one of my least favorite qualities about myself.
It's the worst. I don't mean it's the worst quality
you're
of yourself.
The worst, I mean,
yeah.
Ooh, narcissist.
When you were on the way in, someone said, if you could mirror his internal dialogue to him, that'd be helpful.
It's helping and you're nailing it. Even the voice.
Not great.
No, but I know what you're saying. Yeah. It is like, it's something that we all fall into.
I am agreeing with you because it's something that I try to, I lie to people and say I don't do.
Yeah, we all lie about it. Everyone likes the way it feels to see people interacting with something you post.
Yeah.
And everyone hates the way it feels to see nobody doing it.
Yeah, right.
And so I was like, I'm going to delete this shit. And then I truly did like get high on an edible like that I'd taken before, fell asleep, woke up the next morning, and the song had like done a lot of numbers on TikTok for my like at my following at that point. Like it was blowing up. Thousands of comments, hundreds of thousands of likes. I was like, oh, cool. And then I wrote the chorus that next morning, kind of with that like pep in my step of like, cool, people like it. Here's the chorus.
Dream each night of some version of you that I might not have, but I did not lose. Now your tired tracks in one pair of shoes, and I'm split in half, but that'll have to do.
That's so different than like the story that movies like The Rocker or whatever, like not The Rocker, but like the story that movies tell us about how songs are created. You know, I love that idea that you wrote the verse, got a little too high, fell asleep, which we all do.
Yeah.
You wake up but what a beautiful thing to know that like, oh, hey, I'm hard on TikTok. I'm hard on TikTok and music because I'm 36 and I'm just outside of it.
For sure.
I'm hard on it. And I'm trying not to be hard on it.
No, it's good to be critical sometimes.
I know, but sometimes it veers into old grump or like...
Yeah, old man yells at cloud kind
of. Or maybe like some self-criticism on my part. Like, I don't really get it, so I'm, you know.
Yeah, you feel like outside of it, so it's like everything about it has to suck.
Yeah, exactly.
I get that because I do the same thing. And I'm like, but I had all my success on this app. Like, why am I making fun of everybody? Like, what am I doing?
What I like about it is that you get this moment where you go, oh my God, that verse really works. Now I can write a chorus.
Totally. Yeah, totally. And like what was cool and like I genuinely mean this, like of course a lot of this song was driven by like the fact that people liked it already. But I think I needed to hear that. I was so low confidence in my songwriting and like beyond the point of being critical or being like constructively critical. I was like everything sucks and like it felt really good to write something that felt like a little different from what I was making. It was about Vermont, which is like I didn't think people were going to relate to. It was really just for me. And to see all these people be like, hey, I love this idea. I'm like, cool. Like, there's a lane for this feeling that I have in my songwriting right now, which is like I can write about what I care about at home by myself, not needing to be in a multi-million dollar studio or with a big-time producer. Like, people want to hear what I have to say. And that felt really cool, like, to get that validation. I really needed that at that time.
Isn't there a lesson there? Like, this gets bigger than any of that other stuff you'd done.
Yeah, there is a lesson. I just talked to somebody last night about it. I was like, man, like, I got to make my next record now. And I'm like, I don't know what to do. And he's like, well, last time, didn't you just, like, do whatever the he wanted. And I was like, oh, yeah, maybe I'll try to do that again.
If I can put a point on it, like for people who don't know, like a lot of this record was written in Vermont, right? Like at home in Vermont, and you're like, your folks were going through a divorce and you were, you know, you were home. I love the story about you wearing like your high school soccer outfit. You know what I mean? And you were feeling like you were regressing a little bit.
Yeah.
And then, right?
Yeah, totally. Totally. I was kind of like luck, or I guess it wasn't luck because it was COVID, but I was forced back home by the pandemic. You know, I was forced to reckon with like my parents' relationship again, with my relationship with my siblings, with my relationship with my old friends who were all coming back home. I was back in my hometown. It was like, I just was kind of transported back in time. And I think like what I had was like this new songwriting skill that I'd garnered for years in the music industry and like a live performance background and like a decent sized fan base. But I was back to where I started emotionally. And like that let me kind of access that like inner child that like, just let's just do this because it's fun.
Yeah.
With the tools of like a, you know, seasoned music industry person. And it just felt really good to be making music that like I liked and not thinking about how it was going to propel me forward. I never thought about that when I was making these songs.
Can I ask you about Growing Sideways?
Yeah, of course.
Can we take a listen to it?
And I divvied up my anger into 30 separate parts. Keep the bad in my liver and the rest around my heart. I'm still angry at my parents for what their parents did to them.
Noah Kahan with Growing Sideways from his album Stick Season. A couple of things on that. One is I heard you do an introduction of it, and you said, I've been thinking about all the years I spent lying to therapists, which I've also, I don't know why I've done it, and I stop myself immediately and go, I don't know why I'm about to lie to you.
And then you're like, now I need to talk about that. It's like, why am I lying?
Yeah, now we're not going to get to the thing, to the next session.
Yeah, hey, by the way, should I not be swearing?
Whatever.
Okay, cool, sorry. I'll try
it. I think the rule at the CBC is 3 nights at Scotiabank, you can swear on the CBC.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right.
Listen, if it was 2 nights, you'd be bleeped, buddy.
Two nights, you're kicked out of Canada. Three nights, do whatever you want.
Yeah. One night, you got to host this show.
And going back to the authenticity thing we were talking about earlier, there's a line there that says, I'm terrified that I might have never met me, which tells me that there's another self that you were talking about.
I'm terrified that I might never have met me.
So let's Mr. Brightside that one too. When and where did you write that one?
Yeah, I was in Boston, and I was just spending the day like trying to write a song. This one wasn't like, I want to post a TikTok. I was like, I just want to write a song today and I want to keep it like a little lighter. I think I was going for like these very like, I was trying to be like super deep and like introspective and like smart sounding. And then I just started thinking like, all right, I had just gotten off Zoloft for the first time. I've been taking it for a while and it really helped me. Like, but I felt like it was kind of dulling my creativity a little bit. Like I feel like that's my like fundamental struggle with antidepressants, which I like think I need for my brain, is that a lot of times I feel like the battle is like trying to be creative versus being happy versus, you know, would I rather be happy and like a little numb or like really depressed and creative but like not happy at all. And so I was just thinking about that, and then I started thinking about my experience in therapy. Like I was very privileged growing up. I grew up in a nice area with family of who were able to afford to send me to therapy when I was 8 or 9. And I just couldn't, like, something in me, like, couldn't be honest with, like, the guy in there for a long time because I couldn't be honest with myself, and so it was even harder for me to articulate it. And you can kind of just cheat your way through it. Like, if you just, like, say smart-sounding things or, like, understand the idea of your emotions enough to, like, talk about them in a way that feels like articulate.
You can fool yourself into thinking or convincing them into, that you had a breakthrough.
Right. And it's inherently manipulative, you know, for yourself and for that person.
Yeah.
But I was just clock watching every time. Like, how do I get out of here and seem like I'm making progress? For a long time I just did that, and I would leave being like, well, I went to therapy, so I'm doing better, you know?
Yeah.
And the truth is, like, I was going to therapy, but I wasn't in therapy. I was just putting on a performance. And I did that for a long time. And so I was writing about kind of that feeling of like, maybe I don't have any idea who I am because I've just been dancing around it for so many years. And I used to be like, man, oh, I'm a songwriter. Like, I'm deep and smart and thoughtful. And, like, there's no way that I don't know anything about myself. And I was like, wait, but a lot of these songs, like, are kind of like they're – I was scared that they were kind of like being in therapy. Like, I was just like
– Oh, yeah.
Getting to the surface of an emotion and then, like, talking about it as if I was, like, had dealt with it and understood it really well. Or, like, am I just really good at, like, therapy speak and therapy jargon and, like – and it scared the shit out of me that I like could be sending like a false message out. And I think that might be like a deep fear. And I think that when I wrote those songs, there was a lot of that real feeling in there.
Yeah.
But it, when I was writing Growing Sideways, that was like a fundamental fear of mine, was that I had like just drifted through life without any idea of who I actually was or what I was actually feeling. And that scared me. And I also like the second verse, you know, stopped taking my medication, like, went and spent all my money, like, I from a real experience I had when I first went on Prozac and I went cold turkey off of it.
Oh, no.
Which you're really not supposed to do.
It's really hard on you.
Really hard. I mean, I, like, walked the streets of Los Angeles and got this, like, horrible haircut that I thought looked really cool, and I was, like, super manic and, like, spent a bunch of money on, I don't know if it was Lulu, but I spent a bunch of money on, like, terrible clothing, and I was just walking, like, just like a crazy person walking around because I was like literally having like crazy withdrawals. And so I figured I'd throw that into the song because I thought it was a funny memory and I wanted to shout out Lululemon. So yeah, that's kind of where that song came from.
You're going to get a brand deal out of it. Maybe try to
have it. Okay.
Yeah, come on. We'll make it happen. I appreciate you telling me all that stuff.
Yeah.
So I forgot my medication, fell into a manic high. Spend my savings at a Lulu. Now I'm suffering in style. Ice pain so.
From his album Stick Season Forever, that's my guest Noah Kahn, and a little bit of his song Growing Sideways. More of my conversation with Noah coming up on cue, including the time he wore a wig to Olivia Rodrigo's concert so he could be anonymous, and how that felt after this on cue.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. You're in the middle of my Canadian exclusive conversation with Noah Kahn, one of the biggest singer-songwriters in the world right now, who has over 1 billion streams on Spotify and just wrapped up playing 3 concerts in Toronto to a combined 60,000 people. Yeah. So we've been talking about how quickly this rise to fame happened for him, going from sort of going nowhere to writing songs that were really resonating with people, even though they were so personal and specific to him. And our conversation picks up with something I noticed watching Noah's shows, which is you have this group of young people cheering and applauding when Noah talks about going to therapy. That's where we pick things up. Take a listen. Your crowd, who are like, you know, your age or so, like there's like 10 years in the difference between you and me. It's not a whole lot, but It's enough that like we weren't as open about it.
Yeah.
I watched a Cheers episode the other day where like one of the people, like a rumor got out that one of the people was going to a therapist and everyone was like, what?
Throw him in the woods. I'm so worried about him. He's going to a therapist.
But turns out it was false and he had to convince everybody like, no, I'm not. You know, it turns out he's not. And the resolution of the episode was, okay, good. He's not.
Dude, that's so crazy, man.
And I think even for me, especially as a guy, like I started going when I was 28. What was that? It was like 7 years ago, 8 years ago. I didn't know a whole lot of people.
Yeah.
And and before that, I probably should have gone years before that. And I didn't think it was okay to go. And I had a panic attack and I didn't know what it was because no one told me.
Right.
And I didn't think it was all right, and none of my friends thought it was all right.
Yeah,
it's amazing to see at your shows when you're singing about this stuff, when you say the word like, so I went to see my therapist, and a crowd of 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds flips out.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until like 2 years ago, 3 years ago, when I started to go to therapy, and I started to tell the truth, and I started to feel happier, and I'd never even known what that was like. And as I got better and I started being more honest, I started to look at myself as a younger person. I felt bad for all the time I wasted lying. And I wrote a song about it called Growing Sideways that I want to play.
In addition to it being wild, it also just means that, like, it's okay to have those experiences now. Were you like when you were going, when you were eight, was it okay? Did you feel like, okay, yeah, I can do this?
I think since I didn't know anybody else that was going, and like, I didn't understand why I was there.
Yeah.
Like, I remember being like, why am I here? In hindsight, I'm like, oh my God, of course. I should have been in therapy all day long for 7 days a week. But yeah. I didn't know why I was there. And so I felt like, to me, it was like this, it felt like more work to me. Like, it didn't feel like something that I was like blessed to be able to do. I was like, what is this weird thing I have to go do every week? Like,
okay. There was no shame or stigma around it.
There was no shame or stigma around it. No, because my siblings went and and my parents always supported the idea of like going to talk to somebody about something. And I truly in my head thought that everyone else in my class was having the same experience, that everyone's parents talked to them about that. Like that everyone was like, everybody was like, was fluent in the language of like therapy and like talking about your feelings. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until later on in life that I realized how fortunate I was for that and how rare that was.
Is that why Busy Head exists?
Yeah, it does. And it also exists for the reason of growing sideways. Like I said, I spend a lot of time writing about mental health in my songs and like writing about my anxiety and my fear and depression. And like, that is awesome. I think like, it's cool that I'm able that I do that, whatever. But like putting your money where your mouth is kind of is the reason Busy Head exists. Like, I'm playing arenas now. Like, that comes with like money and, opportunity that I didn't have before. And I would be a waste to not use that platform, that resource for like something really good that actually does the work, like not just singing about it, but actually like raising money for organizations. Like last night, Jack.org came to the show and they are, you know, going to schools and teaching kids about mental health and like making a real difference in like communities across Canada. For me, like being able to support that, like, and give people an opportunity that you might not have had, like, to not feel ashamed or to feel weird about or to have a panic attack before you go to therapy, like, that's something that I can do and that I can help make happen. And like, you know, I'm playing for three nights at Scotiabank. I don't know how many people are. It's like
60,000 people.
60,000 people
over
are
three nights.
Hopefully, going to leave feeling like they can talk about mental health, because I did. Hopefully, that's the goal. So it's an opportunity.
And then the next step is just making sure everyone can get access to it. Because I know you've said that before. Like you said to me just then, you were like, I was lucky enough to have access to resources. And I always want to, whenever I talk about mental health on the show, I always want to say I get insurance through my work, which allowed me to have a subsidized and accessible therapist.
Yeah.
And I just want more people to have that access, you know?
Totally. Like something I wanted to talk about and not to just sit here and get on my soapbox or juice box, whatever the hell the word is.
I think it's juice box.
Get up on my juice box. and like kind of like pat myself in the back, but like something that we started on this tour was we have this company Backline that provides links people in the touring industry with therapists and counselors. And
oh,
like,
lovely.
I think it's something that's really, I really hope that other artists start to do, because like there's a blueprint for it now. And like you said, like getting mental health accessed through your work is like a really, really cool thing. And it's really hard, like getting people access to good, like equitable health, like mental health care in the States. And I can't speak to Canadian healthcare system, but in the States, we really desperately need that. And that's something I'm really, really passionate about. And I want to get more involved in somehow.
Here in Canada too, how's the fame part of that? Fame is unmooring and can mess with you.
I tried sometimes. I feel like I spent so much time being like, I'm not actually, like, no one cares, or like whatever, like I'm not famous, or like I don't like to think of myself like that.
Yeah, of course.
Like, and I hate to admit that, like, there is like attention on me that I didn't have before.
Yeah,
but there is. And like, it's like I'm already super paranoid. Like, I'm paranoid and I'm a weed smoker. already. So I'm always like, oh, that guy's watching me. But now sometimes they are really watching me. That's really hard.
Like, when your weed paranoids come to life.
You walk through a hotel lobby, you're like, why is everyone looking at me? And the cops are coming. And like, oh no, they all are looking at you. Sometimes it's hard, you know, like I think it's just a matter of like feeling like I can't be alone, especially when I'm on tour. I'm like in a city where I'm about to play. That's, you know, when I'm back home, like very rarely will people talk to me or notice me or whatever. But when I'm on tour and I'm like in the city around the venue, like I just feel like I can't relax, you know, like, and I'm trying not to do anything that could be considered like socially unacceptable at all. Like
jaywalk.
I can't jaywalk anymore, dude. I love jaywalking. I absolutely love the jaywalk.
I saw that in your Wikipedia article. Yeah, jaywalking enthusiast.
The rush, dude. The rush of like walking when you're not supposed to walk.
Yeah.
You know, it's, look, like there are a lot of worse things in life than to worry about than somebody coming to ask you for a photo. And I'm grateful. I'm grateful for the exposure I've had, but of course it's uncomfortable sometimes. But man, any job has its pitfalls. Get over it.
I saw the, I don't know if you saw it on my page, I saw that photo of you at the Olivia Rodrigo show with the
with the wig.
I got it here. You want to see it?
Dude, like, I honestly think I look beautiful.
You look great.
Yeah.
This is a podcast and a radio show in addition to being video. Can you say what you're looking at right now?
I'm looking at a photo of myself in a blonde wig. Like, I look, like, with the darkness of my eyebrows and the hair color, like, I do think I resemble a Jennifer Aniston archetype.
Yeah, I can see that. And you're wearing a mask?
I'm wearing a mask.
So the beard's covered?
So the beard is covered.
And you're at an Olivia Rodrigo show because you're going to sing with her, right?
I was about to go on stage with her, and my friends and family were there, and so I was like, I want to go see them, and I want to watch the show. And so I threw my wig on. Her manager actually got me the wig. She's like, I want you to watch the show. And so I was wearing the wig, and I was walking around out there, and nobody noticed at all.
What was that like?
It was awesome, dude. Like, I'm usually like used to like being at like a show where I'm about to go on stage. People will be like, oh, he's about to go on stage. Let's take some photos. No one cared. No one noticed. I was able to like dance and like sing and like, it was the first time that I felt like I could be myself in public, like in a setting where I knew I'd be photographed typically. And it was awesome. Like, it was so freeing. Like, I was just literally just dancing. I know all of Olivia's songs. I was just dancing and singing. And I didn't think anyone was going to find out, which is why you have me in this photo of me shushing the camera. But my favorite part is later on Twitter, like, somebody thought that I was Sabrina Carpenter.
Oh, really? Like the pop star Sabrina Carpenter?
There was a lot of security around her, and she was in a VIP area. I was like, no, that was me and my security guard watching Olivia.
That must have been nice to be able to be yourself at a big show, you know? That's nice.
It was so cool. And also, like, it was cool to have a little super long hair, and I was, like, bouncing it around to all of her songs. And it was cool to be, like, in an environment where it's not at all about me. Like, at all.
Yeah.
It was, like, all about Olivia and all about the fans experiencing it. And I was, like, it was cool to be, like, among the lines of that for a second at a show. It was awesome.
She's good.
She's amazing, man.
You guys got, a friendship. You guys have a mutual respect for one another. I can tell.
I think she's a really, really good person.
Yeah, I think she's a great songwriter.
She's a great songwriter. She's super talented. She's an amazing performer. And she's as nice as you, like, would want her to be.
That's nice.
And, like, you see her on stage, and then you're like, my God, she's, like, a superstar. And then, like, you meet her backstage, and she's like a really nice 21-year-old kid that's like living her dream, doing it the right way, keeping good people around her. I'm inspired by her. Like, I have a lot to learn from her, the way she writes, the way she carries herself. I think it's really impressive. Like, having my little taste of like doing arenas and like having people bothering me sometimes, like at the level that Olivia's experiencing that kind of lifestyle, like for her to be so grounded and for her to be so mature and so like, kind and sweet still with everybody. Like, it's indicative of a really good personality and a really good person. So I think she's dope.
Let me close off this way. How have you changed or not changed since this album came out? There you go.
That's a great question. That's going to keep us here for another 25 minutes, man. How have I changed?
Or not changed?
I think I've been very excited and proud of myself for remaining grateful for all of it. I feel like I don't at any point expect any level of anything. I don't expect a great crowd every night, even though all my crowds are great, but I don't expect the craziest crowd in the world. I don't expect every song to go to number one. And I still feel grateful for every opportunity I do get. I think I've changed my standards for songwriting. Like, I think I sit down, I'm like, oh, dude, like, I love this last album I made. I think those songs are really good. I still think that I should be able to sit down and write a great song every single time.
Yeah.
And that's not how it works.
Yeah.
That's not how it works in any creative endeavor. Yeah. Like,
it's not how it works most of the time.
Yeah, very rarely. And so I'm trying to, I think I've lost a little bit of that patience and a little bit of that groundedness in my songwriting. And I'm desperately trying to find that again, just like remembering that I'm human and that it's not like, it doesn't work like you sit down and you write gold every time. I think seeing people sing the words every night and feeling like this record has really changed some people's, you know, lives, I think, in my life, has created this idea that like everything I need to do needs to be like some groundbreaking thing. And that's just not how it's going to work. So I'm trying to stay, I'm trying to find my way back to a little bit more of a humble mindset around my songwriting. And that's something that I really want to strive to accomplish this year.
Man, it's quite a story.
Thank you.
But all sort of held down. Everything you've told me of all this instability has been really held down by just undeniably great songs.
Thank you, man.
Appreciate you coming in.
Yeah, I appreciate your questions. Thanks a lot.
Kept on driving straight and left our future to the right. Now I am stuck between my anger and the blame that I can't face. And memories or something, even smoking weed is not replaced. And I am terrified of weather because I see you when it rains. Doc told me to travel, but there's COVID on the planes. And I love Vermont, but it's the season of the sticks. And I saw your mom, she forgot that I existed. And it's half my fault, but I just like to play the victim. I'll drink alcohol till my friends come home for Christmas, and I'll dream each night of some version of you.
I remember some friends were telling me about Noah Kahan, and I have a friend who's been playing some music with him, and people were raving about him to me, and I hadn't listened yet. And then I had some friends whose kids were going to Noah Kahan's concerts as their first ever concert. So I'll put it on. I put on that Stick Season song, this one you're listening to right now, and that's just good songwriting. That's just great, great lyric writing right there. Noah Kahan's Stick Season Forever is out everywhere now. He'll also be on tour the next few months. For dates, go to noahkahan.com. If you want to see that conversation we had with Noah Kahan, if you want to send it to someone, youtube.com. It'll be posted today. The other episode we have up today is, you know, living in Hamilton, Ontario now, originally from Edmonton. Cadence Weapon, who is a rapper who wrote essentially a book about becoming a successful rapper because of the internet. And now on his most recent album, like all of us, he's questioning his relationship with the internet. Go check that out. We'll see you soon, later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.